Okay, so today we're going to be continuing in our survey of minor prophets, and we're going to be looking at the prophet Habakkuk. I was raised in Sunday school pronouncing it Habakkuk, and so I don't know how you pronounce it, but I have morphed to Habakkuk. I think when I went to school in the States and they laughed at me for saying Habakkuk, and I didn't want to be laughed at, so I quickly adopted their pronunciation. But you can call him however you want to call him, and that's okay. Okay, so the prophet Habakkuk was living towards the end of the kingdom of Judah. You may remember that the kingdom of Israel was a kingdom of 12 tribes through the reigns of Saul, David, and Solomon, and then it split in two. There was the northern kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah. Eventually, the northern kingdom of Israel was conquered and carried off into captivity, deported, and the other people populated in their place, and that left Judah by themselves. Well, Habakkuk comes towards the end of Judah's time, and Judah wasn't exactly being God's people anymore. We talked about covenant this morning in our Bible class. They were not obeying the covenant. And Habakkuk, as a prophet, is obviously going to be greatly distressed by this, because a prophet's job is to turn the people to God. And the Jews of that time just were not acting like God's people. So we see in the opening verses of the book of Habakkuk, starting in verse 2, he says, "How long, Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen, or cry out violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrongdoing? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous, so that justice is perverted." So the prophet is seeing those people who are supposed to be God's people perpetuating violence, injustice, destruction, strife, conflict, and lawlessness. And he doesn't hold anything back from God. It's like, why aren't you doing anything about this? Why do you make me look at this? He's very real in his accusations almost to God. But then when Habakkuk presents his dilemma to God, like we're supposed to anytime that we're in situations, all the time, actually, he finds God's answer equally appalling. Because after Habakkuk lodged his complaint that God was ignoring the sins of his own people, God did respond. But Habakkuk, if anything, was even more displeased with God's response. Because in verse 5, God says, "Look at the nations and watch, and be utterly amazed. For I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe even if you were told. I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwellings not their own." And then in verses 7 through 11, God proceeds to talk in great detail about just how horrible these people are and how horrible the things that they will do to Judah. Well, that wasn't exactly what Habakkuk wanted to hear. He wanted to hear that God was going to sweep in and make things right, set his people back on the right track, you know, make Judah great again, so to speak. So Habakkuk responds to God. Okay, so Habakkuk has leveled his accusations to God. God has responded. Habakkuk is still not pleased. So Habakkuk responds again to God's response in the latter half of chapter 1, verses 12 through 17, basically saying, how can you, a holy God, find people even worse than Judah to conquer them? And then in chapter 2, verse 1, after he has responded to God, he says, "I will stand at my guard post and station myself on the watchtower. and I will keep watch to see what he will say to me, and how I may reply when I am reprimanded. I find that verse very amusing. Habakkuk is pretty sure by this point that he's stepped over the line. Having criticized God not once but twice, once for the initial situation, and the second time for God's intent on how to deal with the situation. So he's saying, you know, I'm just going to watch to see what happens, and I'm already going to start figuring out what I'm going to say when God reprimands me. Interesting thing is, God doesn't reprimand him. It's okay to go to God and be raw and real and say, this is how I'm feeling. And God's big enough to handle that. But here we get a glimpse into the degree of absolute frustration that Habakkuk is feeling. In essence, he's saying, let's see how he'll respond to this one. And God does respond again. And he says in chapter 2, write this down. You can count on this to happen in verse 2. Verse 3, he says, it will be on my timetable, not yours, but it will happen. Verse 4, he says, the enemy is not righteous. The righteous will live by faith. So the translation of what God is saying here is, the Babylonians will get theirs too. You don't like what I'm doing right now? Judah is evil, Babylon is more evil, and yet I'm sicking Babylon on Judah? Well, they'll get theirs too. They're not going to get away scot-free. Well, by this time, Habakkuk had a lot to chew on. He had complaints about his own brethren, by nationality and theoretically by faith. He had complaints about the avenue with which God would deal with the first complaint. But God had answered his complaints, even though he was far from thrilled with those answers. The one thing he had to notice was God was not ticked with him. This would probably cause Habakkuk to decompress a little bit, to deal a bit more rationally with the situation, now that there was no argument brewing. So in chapter 3, we see Habakkuk reflect on the covenant, okay? Now, a covenant is God's agreement with his people, or at least in this context. As we said in Bible class this morning, covenants were a fairly common thing in the ancient Near East. It was something that the people would have been familiar with, a concept they were familiar with when God brings it in and creates his covenant with his people. An agreement of how the people are to act, promises of blessing if they keep the covenant, threats of curses if they do not. And so Habakkuk reflects on this covenant in chapter 3. In verses 1 and 2, he says, I've heard of your mighty works, Lord, and it'd sure be nice if you would do them again in this day. And then in verses 3 through 15, Habakkuk reflects on Israel's origin story. 3 and 4 talks about his splendor was like the sunrise, rays flashed from his hand where his power was hidden, talking about God coming to the aid of Israel in Egypt. Verses 5 through 7 talks about the plagues of Egypt. Verses 8 through 10, a picture of God to the rescue. He says in verse 9, you uncovered your bow, you called for many arrows. And verses 11 through 15 talks about the defeat of the Egyptian army. You trampled the sea, verse 15, you trampled the sea with your horses, churning the great waters. So Habakkuk is spending time reflecting on Israel's origin story, on the time when they were, because they had gone into Egypt as 70 people, as a family, an extended family. They come out 400 years later, millions of people. And their freedom from slavery in Egypt is the beginning of their country. They mark everything from the escape from Egypt. So Habakkuk is reflecting on all of this. And then in verse 16, it's like he gives his head a shake to bring himself back from reflecting on Israel's glory days. And he's back to thinking about the present reality. The Babylonians are coming. And you know it's going to happen because it's God himself who has said it. In his heart of hearts, Habakkuk knows that Judah's breaking of the covenant has brought about this horrific overthrow. God has spoken, and there's no getting past it. But in verse 16 of Habakkuk 3, everything I've heard has me paralyzed with fear. But Habakkuk has also been given the assurance from God that the Babylonians will get theirs as well. So with the knowledge that after Judah gets taught their lessons, the Babylonians will also fall, he says in verse 16, yet I will wait patiently for the day of calamity to come on the nation invading us. I'll wait. I'll watch for these enemies to get what's coming to them. Waiting patiently. When we come to life's unanswerable questions, when we come to the challenges, the storms of our lives, in the same way that Habakkuk is trying to grapple with the horrific problems that he's seeing all around him, the problems of his own people not acting the way his own people should be acting, the problems with an even worse country coming in and overthrowing them, we as humans lack the perspective that only God in his infinite wisdom can possess. Okay. Habakkuk didn't understand why God would deal with things the way he does. Similarly, we don't understand why things happen to us in our lives that stink, things that are horrible, diagnoses that we receive, friends that betray us. The list goes on and on. Poverty, job loss, not being able to afford the crazy rents and house prices in the GTA these days. You name it, we've got problems. And we need to learn, as Habakkuk did, that God's ways don't always make sense to us. Isaiah said in Isaiah 55, 8 and 9, my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. So the question comes down to us, do we trust God? Do we trust God in the difficulties in our lives? God says, there's reasons for things that are happening, and you don't necessarily know what they are. But my ways are so much higher than your ways, like the heavens are above the earth. That's how much my ways are higher than your ways. Do you trust me? Says God. So let's hear Habakkuk's final response to all of this mess. In chapter 3, verses 17 through 19, Habakkuk pens these famous words, though the fig tree does not bud, and there are no grapes on the vines, though the olive crop fails, and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God my Savior. The sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He enables me to tread on the heights. Habakkuk knows that he is headed for a time when he, along with the entire nation, will be living under God's curse. Because the nation has broken the covenant, the curses that have been pronounced are about to be realized. Everything that he mentions in verse 17 can be found in the curses in Deuteronomy 28. Swarms of locusts will take over all your trees and the crops of your land. You will plant vineyards and cultivate them, but you will not drink the wine or gather the grapes, because worms will eat them. You will have olive trees throughout your country, but you will not use the oil, because the olives will drop off. You will sow much seed in the field, but you will harvest little, because locusts will devour it. Your sheep will be given to your enemies, and no one will rescue them. They will devour the young of your livestock and the crops of your land until you are destroyed. They will leave you no grain, new wine, or olive oil, nor any calves of your herds or lambs of your flocks until you are ruined. Every single thing that Habakkuk has just said, though the fig tree doesn't blossom, though there be no fruit on the vine, the produce of the olive fails, and the trees, the fields yield no fruit, though the flocks be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stall, even though I am relegated to living under God's curse, I'll complain, but I'll grit my teeth? No. Yet will I rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God my Savior. I will not only just be faithful, but I will be faithful and look for that joy that comes from knowing that God still loves me, even in the time of curse. How many of us as parents have ever disciplined our children? Painful experience for the kid, painful experience for the parent. But if they were well raised, they knew even in the process of being disciplined that they were still loved. And Habakkuk knew that even though he was going to be living under God's curse, that he was still loved, that he would find joy in being God's child. Yet will I rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God my Savior. Not only would he be faithful with joy, but he would actually find the ability to rise above what he was dealing with. The sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He enables me to tread on the heights. Is that not a beautiful, beautiful picture of what not only Habakkuk could do, could expect, but what we can do when we are faced with the storms of life, when we are faced with the challenges of life? We can still serve God. We can still serve God faithfully, unconditionally. We can still find joy in being God's children. And most of all, we can rise above all the horrible things that life throws our way. How do you respond when difficulties surround you, when subjected to suffering, even unjust suffering? Unlike Habakkuk, the difficulties we encounter in life are not likely to be ever as horrific as his, nor are they likely to be the result of covenant breaking, as we are under a completely different kind of covenant. But life still throws plenty of challenges our way, and it's up to us to handle them in a godly way. Life is full of challenges, but they must not distract us, must not cause us to take our focus off of God, trusting him whose ways are higher than our ways and whose thoughts are higher than our thoughts. Not taking our focus off of God. Do you remember the story of Peter wanting to walk on the water to Jesus? And Jesus said, come. And he stepped out of the boat, and it says he walked on the water until he saw the wind and the waves. At that moment, he lost his focus, and he began to sink. We cannot allow the problems that come into our lives to take our focus off of Jesus. We must continue to faithfully, unconditionally serve him. Every challenge that we meet can be considered another attempt by our enemy to distract us from that wholehearted devotion to Christ and steal our joy. I leave with you the opening verses of this morning's reading. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. We run with perseverance the race that is marked out for us, looking to Jesus, not losing our focus, keeping our eyes on him, the author and perfecter of our faith. Our closing hymn, number 399, reminds us that Jesus calls us over the tumult of our lives' wild, restless waves. Day by day, his sweet voice soundeth, saying, Christian, follow me. Jesus calls us o'er the tumult of this vain world's golden store. From each idol it would keep us, saying, Christian, love me more. Everything that would cause us to lose our focus are the things that this hymn writer has said. Jesus calls us to rise above these things. And so I ask you this morning, rise above the difficulties in your life, not losing your focus on Jesus, but giving faithful, unconditional service to him, looking for that joy, looking for that ability to rise above and have the strength that comes only from God. Let's stand and sing 399.